jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jub.
Hello and a welcome to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to finish up my thoughts about Richard Wright, his book, The Outsiders, and maybe overall my thoughts on Richard Wright. There's not too much more to say about the book itself, if you've been listening along. Really, the last book focuses on Cross's relationship with the state, represented by this this district attorney, Houston, who... challenges him on some of his ideas and his kind of lack of values. There's a lot of questioning. Basically, he becomes a suspect here. And they have this long conversation and back and forth about communism and values and things like that. And we get out of this basically Cross Damon's like nihilism and his kind of lack of any clear values. I mean, listen to this conversation. I'm asking, do you hate communism? Houston insisted. How can one hate communism? He asked, smiling. Then you love communism? No. Are you a member of any so-called Revolutionary Party? No. Were you ever a member of the Communist Party? No. And I've never been a fascist either. I know that. How could you know that? Cross asked. Houston blinked, pulled down the corner of his mouth. You're a Negro. Negroes can be fascist too, Cross told him. Are you a fascist then? No. A fascist angle is not important. They would take you in anyway. How? Houston said with a tinge of satisfaction. Fundamentally, fascism has nothing to do with race, Cross told him. And, quote, and that's the kind of moment you're like, wait a minute. Like, is that Wright's point of view? Because I guess in a strict sense, fascism, you know, could exist in any authoritarian right-wing nation state. And in that sense, you could have majority black countries become fascist, majority white countries fascist, right? Obviously, we've seen it mostly in European-derived countries, I guess. But there are fascist elements, I suppose, you could say, in maybe communist China or whatever. If you want to make that case, that's there to make. I'm not going to jump into that with both feet. But to say fascism has nothing to do with race is to ignore the actual historical legacy of existing fascism, which very much was about racial definitions of statehood and nationalism and membership in that nationhood, especially the Nazis. They saw fascism as an extension of a racial identity. But of course, the reader is also taken aback by all the denialism of Cross's opinion about this, that he just doesn't seem to have any strong values about the ideology. There's kind of an emptiness to how he thinks about things. He at one point says, I hate the fascists more than the communists, but he certainly hates them both. And I guess that's kind of a mainstream American view in the 1950s. It's that communism and fascism were both bad and both part of that authoritarian tradition and both should be struggled against. The fact that Richard Wright kind of buys into this with this weird kind of amorphous, two hands up, like it's the emoji, right? Whatever. I'll kill everyone if they kind of offend me. Really, really bizarre. Okay, now Houston at some point in this last chapter also exposes his real identity, and he has to confront with that and his relationship. He's questioned about whether he loves his family, if he loves his mother. His mother even died, and he didn't know, and he's kind of a little bit indifferent to that. He actually says at one point he doesn't love his family. Yeah, he knows his mother died, but he doesn't care. He doesn't love his family. He doesn't know why he committed these crimes. He's not making himself off as a very sympathetic character. And that's why I found Bigger Thomas's struggles a little more compelling, because he didn't come off as so indifferent and so I get this feeling Damon Cross is just being strung along by circumstances, and he never really takes a firm position about anything. And that's a little off-putting, to be honest. The characters, the development we see in Native Son and Black Boy, which of course is semi-autobiographical, are just much, they're easier to get into the head and feel that you are this character, I guess. So not much else happens. We see eventually he is found out that he's the murderer. Obviously, Houston kind of finds it out. Now, he doesn't actually have to go through the whole like criminal process that takes up a big bulk of Native Son. Instead, he's just like a victim of a violent crime, and then he's laying there dying, and Houston comes to see him at the end, and we get this conclude this conversation at the end of his life, where he says, Houston says, "Do you understand what I mean, Damon? I'm talking about you, your life. How was it with you?" Because he's asking him about his life. Why, you know, kind of. Now, I do want to stop here in a second and talk about like the psychiatric response to existentialism, right? Because in the early 20th century, psychiatry was influenced by Freudism, by psychoanalysis on the one hand, and behaviorism on the other. And both of these kind of present human personalities and humanity as a self, their psychological state, as determined by outside forces. For the psychoanalysts, it's like that, it's the oral anal stage, you know, where you are, those tensions, if they're unresolved, you know, in your childhood, or you have the id, superego, ego group, and the ego is kind of burdened by the superego and the id. You're not really in control of your thoughts all the time. You have the subconscious or the unconscious, I should say. And then you have the behaviorist who basically, at the radical, most radical form, say, we're just simply programmed. We are programmed by conditioning, right? Pavlov's dog or Skinner's little mouse houses that he, you know, the mouse, the Skinner boxes, you know, the rats in the maze kind of thing. But the existentialists, of course, their philosophy rests on this idea of freedom, that this radical freedom, which Cross has, his death on that boat, or on that train, I mean, gives him radical freedom. And what he does with it is he kind of squanders it. And maybe that's the point of the book, ultimately. It's not really like what we get with Bigger Thomas, where you come away feeling the system made his choice, like locked him into choices. Cross Damon, it doesn't quite feel that way. He actually could have been welcomed by the communists. He could have made a new life for himself. Yeah, he still would have been living in a Jim Crow society, but you know, he wasn't as bound, I think, as Bigger Thomas. You feel when you read Bigger Thomas. I don't know. Now, maybe that's either extreme. Either both characters might be wrong. I mean, they might not be accurate to the times. Obviously, I think James Baldwin thought that Richard Wright was kind of caricaturing Black Americans. But when you have these two very different characters that make very different choices and seem to have different limits, I don't know. But anyways, the point of existentialist psychiatry, as I understand it, comes from like William Frankl, right? This man's search for meaning is that given whatever restraints you have, you still have control over how you write the story of your life and how you understand it and the goals you set for yourself and the meaning you give to those goals. And of course, Maslow, I think, is the one who says you need to have, you need to have like a challenge. You need to have, it has to be meaningful, challenging, and achievable or something. Maybe it's like, no, satisfying. It has to be satisfying to you. But it also has to be challenging, because just doing something you already mastered, putting together the same puzzle every day, reading the same book, playing the same video game, it's not challenging anymore, right? But it's also got to be meaningful. So again, like playing Pac-Man all day might be challenging and satisfying, but it may not ultimately be meaningful. You need kind of all three. But whatever you set, you're free to set those goals and define them and achieve them, and that's this meaning. And part of that is like writing the story of your life. When someone says like, you know, write your own story or something, that is coming from this existentialist psychiatric tradition, right? A criticism of behaviorism. And Houston's trying to do that here. I guess that's the point of that long digression. So he's asking about his life, and this is what we get. His eyes stared bleakly. His effort was supreme. His lips parted. His tongue moved. He cursed the damn ball, the seething fire that raged in his chest, and managed to get out reluctant breath past it to make the words, It was horrible. Then there was a short silence, and Houston's voice came again. What do you mean? What was horrible? The effort to keep his heavy eyes open was too much, and it was not worth trying. He stopped fighting and let his lids droop, and darkness soothed him for a moment. Once more, he struggled grimly to control his lips, his tongue, to still that exploding ball of fire and leap white hot in his chest. Then he said in a soft, falling, dying whisper, all of it. But why? Why? Tell me. Try and tell me. Because in my heart, I felt I'm innocent. That's what made the horror. He felt his dull head falling helpless to one side. Huge black shadows were descending softly upon him. He took the chest full of air inside. He was dead. And so that's the end of Cross Damon and the end of the book, and really the end of what I'm going to cover with Richard Wright. Now, I will point out, Library of America did publish another book by him, but it's one of his standalone things. It was a posthumously published book that maybe I've heard kind of goes between these two. And it's about police violence. So maybe we'll get to it at some point, but I don't have it, so I'm not going to read it, but at least not now. But anyways, dealing with this ending, again, I don't know. Okay, he feels he's innocent. He's objectively not. He killed four people, really, over bullshit. Now, maybe they weren't the nicest people. The first guy and the last guy he killed definitely didn't seem to deserve it. Hilton is killed because Cross Damon just didn't want to be recruited into the party and felt they were kind of lording over him. Gil and the landlord, maybe they're the closest we have to a justification for killing them, and that there were gods that he had to strike down or something. And the first murder, clearly unjustified, just a guy recognized him and he has to kill him to prevent. Now, that death may have been made worth it had Cross Damon done something meaningful with his life from that point on. But he doesn't. And again, it's I really feel this with this kind of with Law Today. I like Law Today a lot more as a book. I think the characterization is more interesting. The scenes are more interesting. It's a little easier to slip into that. If you remember me talking about it, I felt that novel really popped. But that character also dug his own grave in a way. Yes, he's in, but unlike Bigger Thomas, less so. Bigger Thomas seems to have been really had less autonomy, right? And in Law Today, the character certainly lived in a Jim Crow society, faced racism, faced prejudice, and that's going to help explain his life, why he had limited opportunities. But he didn't do much with what he had, and he certainly made things worse for himself through bad choices. And I don't know if Richard Wright's trying to say that they don't even have that degree of freedom, but certainly he gives Cross Damon as much freedom as a black man could have in America at the time. And, by giving him a fresh start, essentially. And it would be an interesting story if that doesn't matter. We find out he's facing the same struggles and the same burdens, and he can't achieve any of his goals because of racism, then you're condemning race in America. Easy to do. And you're like, oh, it's not enough. It's not about who you are as an individual. This is as far as you can go in American society. That'd be interesting. Or if he was able to do something with his life, that'd be interesting in the existentialist interpretation, that once freed of his identity, he can create a new identity that can have meaning, right? I think that's what's missing is Richard Wright never wants to give Cross Damon meaning in life, right? Houston tries at the end to say, why are you on this planet? What was the story of your life? And he's just like, life is shit. And I didn't really do anything wrong. It feels like I didn't do anything wrong. And that kind of makes me feel a little uncomfortable. Well, what am I supposed to do with this? I don't know. I'm very frustrated with this book, clearly. I spent a lot of time on it. There's parts where I thought it more promising. I liked the first half of the book. Book one was good. Book two was good. I think three, four, and five, the book sort of goes off the rails. And leaves me very kind of with the sour taste in my mouth about this writer who I've been loving for weeks now. So I don't know. Richard Wright, is it the generational thing? I kind of want to read Ellison now because he's that same generation. And Wright's really the only representative we have of particularly this generation. We read Du Bois. We looked at his stuff, earlier generation. James Weldon Johnson, earlier generation. Charles Chestnut, earlier generation. If you go back in this podcast, I've covered a lot of these writers. And the slave narratives, of course, that's a whole different social, economic, material context. And then we're going to be looking at James Baldwin, and he's going to be a representative, I guess, of like the 60s generation, 70s, 80s, the Black Power generation and all that. Richard Wright kind of stands in this 30s, 40s period, right, which is kind of the nadir of race relations. Oh, I want to add, early in this podcast, I did the Harlem Renaissance writers, but that also is like Richard Wright's between them. He's between the Harlem Renaissance, turn of the century writers, and like the civil rights generation. You know, he dies in 1960, so he sees some gains in civil rights, but not enough to convince him to come back to America. So, you know, of course, James Baldwin leaves too, but he seems to stay in conversation with civil rights. He comes back to America and does his debates that made him famous and seems more of America, seems less of an exile. I get the sense from Richard Wright that he kind of was a deep, deep exile from his own world. And he doesn't even want to go back to understand and experience Black America because he just sees it as like a black pit. Well, James Baldwin, like in Gold Tell on the Mountain, he's like celebrating a religion that he himself has turned his back on, but he finds life and joy and experiences that are really, really meaningful. I don't want to say just optimist versus pessimist because I don't think that's really what's going on here, and I have to reread a lot more of Baldwin to get there. But I got a sense of a more lived-in world when I opened up Go Tell It on the Mountain. It's like, again, it's like popping the way like Law Today popped, where you're like, you're just experiencing these people going to church and the singing and the dancing and the passions and the desires and all that. And this book is just a black hole. And I'm kind of bummed out by it, to be honest. And I guess I'll leave it at that. I'll leave this on a negative note too, that Richard Wright in the end bums me out. And do I want to go back and reread Native Son? Yeah, maybe not as eagerly as I was thinking about that before I went to The Outsider. Obviously, I have a lot more things to read. But Black Boy, like the stories in Uncle Tom's Children and Lodge Today, these are all like really top-notch books. Are they bleak? Yeah, they're all pretty bleak. But the writing is sharper. It's less convoluted. It's fewer of these like philosophical dissertations popped in, and less of this weird relationship with communism, a little more hopeful representation of the Communist Party and what it means to America. Those books, I can walk away from this series. Now, maybe saying 4 out of 5 is not bad, Lampy, accept it. Yeah, I'm fine with that. It's like, am I going to go back and pick up The Outsider anytime soon? I probably have to be in a pretty dark place to do it. And even then, I don't really want to go back and read to his commentary on communism versus fascism. If I want weird commentary on communism versus fascism, I'll go back to the Lovecraft letters. So that's that. That's my thoughts on it. So looking ahead, James Baldwin. Pretty excited to get into him. We're going to start with Go Tell It on the Mountain, 2 episodes on that book. So starting probably sometime next week, I'll upload my thoughts on Go Tell It on the Mountain. I'll probably read the whole book and then do 2 episodes back to back or something. But yeah, I'm trying to find a good audiobook for that. I found one kind of self, just a YouTuber reading. And it's not bad. I'll use that if nothing else. But, you know, when I'm commuting and walking around, it's good to have these audiobooks to keep me productive. But yeah, so we're going to do 4 novels in a row. Go Tell It on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room, Another Country, and Going to Meet the Man. And I'm actually pondering here, like, Now, obviously, I don't know the sexuality of every writer we looked at, but is this our first queer writer in this very, very long podcast? It almost made me feel bad. Maybe if I go back, and maybe some of these writers, like Melville, I guess, you know, he's been called a queer writer sometimes, but is he the first out and open gay writer that I've looked at? I hope he's not the last. I have to do an audit at this point to deduce this. We've actually talked about sexuality quite a lot in this series, but never before a gay writer. So, maybe because it's a big theme of his work, right? At least what I remember. So I guess that's a milestone, I guess, if true, but kind of one that makes me a little embarrassed that it took me that long to get to a queer writer. Anyways, that's it for now. Anyways, thanks for listening. Sorry to kind of leave you on a sour note with Richard Wright. I still like him. I still think he's a good representation of that period. It's just, I don't know what to do with The Outsider. I kind of wish I didn't read it, but I'd feel better about Richard Wright at this point, but I don't know. I kind of get where Baldwin's coming from now, when he kind of, that early attraction and then that later kind of, this is a bit weird. Yeah, we've all had friends like that, I suppose. So anyways, that's it for now. See you next time, and thanks for listening. By jingle, and every night they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh, by gollies. Then we'll put them in the follies.